This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 55th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm pleased to have today with me Deb Frinke. Hi, Deb.
Hi, Gary. Nice to be here.
Deb Frinke is Chief Scientist of Cybersecurity at the Pacific Northwest National Lab, where she's been since 2004. Dr. Frinke was professor at the University of Idaho, where she co-founded the Center for Secure and Dependable Systems. She's active in the Department of Energy's cybersecurity grassroots community. She's also an affiliated professor with the University of Washington's iSchool. Dr. Frinke is an active academician with over 50 publications. She works on intrusion detection, system defenses, and collaboration in distributed systems. Deb lives in Idaho, where she oversees a forest full of daffodils with her husband. Her PhD is from UC Davis. So thanks for joining us today, Deb.
Nice to be with you, Gary.
I didn't know your last name was pronounced like Pinky.
Well, we decided to make it hard on everyone. That's a little bit of German cryptography, I guess.
So you've worked as a professor, an entrepreneur, and a researcher. What are the similarities and differences between those three professions, and which do you like the most?
Oh, which do you like the most is a hard question. I think the similarity is that it helps to be entrepreneurial in all of those, Gary. If you wait for someone to tell you what to do, you can't have any fun in any of the three different roles.
So some differences between, say, being a professor and being a researcher then?
Well, I would say being a professor, the main goal that I had in any case was to educate the students, and then after that was to make scientific discoveries. So in general, when we were approaching the science at University of Idaho, it was in order to help the next generation of researchers learn what was next. And so my emphasis was more on what they were able to uncover as opposed to what I was able to do. Mm-hmm. When I found moving over to Pacific Northwest National Lab, the job now is actually science as a business. And so the goal is to make science that's useful, and that emphasis has to be on useful as well as on the science.
Right.
And it does make a little bit of difference in the kinds of problems that you approach and the way you go about approaching them.
Yeah, it does. In my own experience, technology transfer is really difficult, and it often takes a decade to get a technology successfully transferred out into the field, with a whole bunch of technologies languishing in the valley of death. So what does the Pacific Northwest National Lab do to support or encourage technology transfer?
I guess we're having the same difficulties a lot of people are. And the problem is you come up with a lot of good technologies you need to pick and choose. So what we do try to do to make that transition easier is to think ahead as to who's actually going to use the research outcome of what we're doing. So before we began our major internal initiative investment, I needed to spend about a year talking to potential outside clients who would be consumers of the research. And I needed to go through and identify how long it would take us to come up with different discoveries and try to identify whether that would be useful in terms of national usefulness as well as fiscally responsible for us to go that route, mm-hmm. and convince our business department of it. And that's not something I'd have done as a faculty member, I have to tell you.
So one would presume that your role as an entrepreneur doing startup stuff, or at least being familiar with startup stuff, was helpful in that capacity and rare.
It did. It was good. It wasn't quite as much of a shock to go there and find out I needed to make a business case for science. The entrepreneurial role at Idaho was more of a shock factor there, I'd say. Here I thought we had developed the next best, latest, and greatest comprehensive research approach, only to find out that in order to get that thing to transfer, we needed to scale way back which elements of the discovery could actually be used.
Mm-hmm.
A little different form of scientific business case.
Mm-hmm. And what have you learned about what it takes to do a startup?
Doing a startup is hard. I think I learned is that it takes a great deal of focus on who is going to use it and who is going to pay for it and how are you going to get people to realize that they want what you have.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's not something you normally think about as a professor, that how do you get people to want what you have. But on the entrepreneurial side, we didn't really make much traction until we brought in people that were very good at the business and marketing end, mm-hmm. who knew how to phrase what we were doing instead of emphasizing how wonderful this is for science into how much of an improvement it would make in the daily lives of somebody else who would be willing to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. So how rare do you think it is to have in one person kind of experience in academia, in real science land, in entrepreneur land, you know, the whole shebang. Is it common or is it rare?
I'd say it's fairly rare. I know a number of other researchers who do have that background. Sal Stolfel comes to mind, but I'd say it's fairly uncommon, particularly since my role at PNNL involves not just the open research, but the classified research, too. But there are a few of us who've gone that a little bit more of a windy route to our careers.
I did want to ask you about classified stuff. So much government cybersecurity stuff is classified, sometimes for no apparent reason. As an example, consider CNCI, which was established as a classified program under Bush and only recently declassified by Obama. In your view, is classification used to mask incompetence in cybersecurity, or is there some stuff that really needs to be classified?
I knew I'd need to be careful having an interview right before Halloween with you, Gary.
Hey, I asked McConnell the same thing last week. He had a very interesting answer.
Well, I think that for me, what I'm seeing is that much of what's classified has to do with the methods and the methodologies. I'm not certain that I've seen it used to mask incompetence, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't necessarily be looking at any program that would have that as an issue.
Doesn't make it to your pay grade.
Well, at least let's hope I would recognize it if I saw it. But what we try to do is we do try to make sure, and part of my role at PNNL is to make sure that the most important things that we're doing on the classified side are appropriately released.
Mm-hmm.
When I've seen things classified, it really does have more to do with some kind of a method that's being kept secret or some particular thing that if it were released would endanger a specific system.
Right, right.
That's more of my expertise.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. I just worry about science and classification seem to work at cross purposes. I know we have to have some secrets, but the whole idea behind science is to be peer reviewed and to have people criticize your work and try to fix it. You know?
Exactly so. I've actually been on a bit of a crusade about that. What I have noticed is that people do a little less publishing on the classified side than I'd like to see,
mm-hmm.
because there are some things where if a person put in that extra mile that we often do in academia, you could do a bit more in publishing. Now, that's not to say that the work as is could go forward, but mm-hmm. that with a little extra work, you could desanitize, and that can often be very tricky. And a few of us are trying to find some way of having a classified journal or a peer-reviewed publication that comes out regularly in that community so that they can have the advantage of peer review.
Right.
I'm less worried about the information being transitioned out externally in that sense than the people on the inside are not getting the benefit of that scrutiny.
Exactly.
It makes you a little bit careless.
You get your benefits of compartmentalization and also some hazards come along with that.
And that's something we're going to need to watch.
Okay, so that's enough on that one. Now you can breathe a sigh of release. Almost, maybe. So in my view, here's a tough one. The Department of Energy should be all over smart grid cybersecurity implications. But I worry that they're not. So who's in charge of that? Who's supposed to be watching the smart grid stuff from a security perspective?
Smart grid is one of those things that's going to challenge us as a culture, Gary, and I'm saying that because much of what's going to go on in smart grid is owned by industry.
Right.
Smart grid illustrates better than almost anything I know of that tie that has to happen between an industry-owned infrastructure that's benefiting the public, so the citizens of the country and of the world, and a government need to keep an infrastructure safe because it's in the best national interests of the population.
But what I see is, you know, this big push to basically hang a naked PC off of everybody's house, which has a whole bunch of incredibly cool things that can happen as a result, but also from a security perspective is problematic from just keeping the thing up.
It is. I think that this is a little bit like the iPods. We're all hanging nakedly off of our PCs right now, except that the implications of misusing them is a little bit greater.
Right, right, right. Yeah, so we have a lot of work to do there. But, you know, in the interest of making a big impact in the efficiency of energy distribution, kind of going from, you know, one-to-one to many or something like that. Less of a broadcast. I don't know how to explain it exactly. But there's some trade-offs that we're making when we do that. I guess I wish we were thinking more carefully about that stuff.
Yes, I think that we do need to focus on that. Now, there's some bright spots. I like what I'm seeing in TSIP-G, the study of the infrastructures.
Mm-hmm.
I really like seeing the new NETL program coming out of Department of Energy, which is investing in some long-term thinking about cybersecurity structures.
Excellent.
Part of the problem we've got is that in some cases with smart grid, part of that train has already left the station, you know, Gary, because we are working right now on smart grid meters that are intended to meet the needs of today.
So yes.
We're not projecting into the future there. But some of these other investments, well, if we're willing to pay some heed to the researchers, will be useful things down the road.
I think they would be.
Still 10 years before we can make use out of the new technology we invest in today.
Well, and some of the stuff that we're hanging off of houses today, you know, you can order one for yourself off of eBay, and some of the hacker boys have done that and then decompiled the code and found buffer overflows and rooted the boxes, and you just go, this is not so good.
And given that I live in a rural environment, here we are. We're generating some of our own energy.
Yeah, you guys probably have lots of wind power out there, huh?
We do. I do a lot with solar here. We've done some geothermal to heat the house, and our meter is read by us mostly and phoned in. So if you want to think about that, the model, it's a little different than the city.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I'm more of a country boy myself, although we don't even have an electric meter. Electricity is something we're hoping for in the future.
You and I are dinosaurs.
We'll be right back after this message. The landmark 50th episode of the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw is an interview with cybersecurity luminary Richard A. Clark. The episode was recorded in high-definition video and is available on the Silver Bullet website, www.sigital.com/silverbullet, as well as on YouTube. Make sure to check out the video. So a question towards your research. The fog of war is a well-known situational awareness challenge. And in my view, cyber war is going to add a dimension of speed, fast-forwarding things like we've never seen before. How does your situation awareness work in network security deal with the issue of speed?
Speed is probably the second greatest challenge with a next generation war. The first, I think I would say, is where it's being fought, which is essentially in the living rooms and the smart devices we have in our homes. For speed, there are a couple of challenges, and one approach that we are working on for our standpoint is to be as proactive and predictive as possible. We're coupling that with a view of resilience. So the hope is that by thinking in advance as much as one can, and of course you can't predict the future, and the further in advance you attempt to do it, the less likely you are to get it accurately. You're really looking at multiple futures when you're doing prediction in any case.
Mm-hmm.
Coupling that with some form of resilience so that when your guess is wrong, as it inevitably is, you have some way of writing the situation. But I see that as mainly needing to be on trips. So the human involvement is going to need to be from the big picture, taking a look at what the broad scheme of things is,
right,
and try to set up goals and directives as opposed to being hands-on management.
At human level speed.
Exactly. Human level compared with internet speed, near real-time speed. It's an entirely different way of dealing with warfare.
Well, you know, we're dealing with that in trading systems as well. So the market crash in May that was caused by the super fast trading systems, the dark pools stuff that got caught in a very bad race condition. This is something that most people that built these markets didn't anticipate. And I think we're seeing that effect all over the place. We're going to see it in cyber war as well.
The more you look, the more you see it. If you think about autopilots and airlines, when sometimes we have autopilot saving a plane from a crash, other times you have the autopilot making exactly the wrong move from the standpoint of the human in the loop.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see the same thing in cyber warfare.
Right. We need more people with a computer security clue in this country and in our government. So how can we or should we address that need?
Well, of course, as an academician, I'd love to see a lot more of this taught in the institutions. And by that, I don't mean necessarily just at the college level. I think we need a lot more going on at the K-12, just helping people be digitally savvy. They'll look both ways before you cross the cyber street mantra, for instance. if our kids are a bit more understanding of some of the trade-offs, they'll make better adults and more informed citizens. But in the meantime, we've got a major problem in that most of the people who are running things at the government level, of course, didn't come up through a technology background. And they're learning about it, and the devices are evolving underneath them. So outreach from people that understand, people like yourselves, people at the institutions that understand the needs of government as well as cybersecurity is going to be absolutely critical. And I'm very much hoping that our politicians and community leaders will be listening to those of us with something to offer from the technology side.
Do you think we've made reasonable progress in there? I know you were involved in the NSA Centers of Excellence and talking about curricula and stuff like that for quite a long time. You think we're going in the right direction?
Sometimes I say yes, and it's close to Halloween. I more think about it as we're still continuing to keep our head above water, Gary.
You really got a thing for Halloween, don't you?
I do. Well, I suppose this time of year we think about the tricks and the treats. But the problem's gotten harder, I think, faster than we've gotten good at it. And we've made huge strides on the academic side. I think that if most disciplines looked at how much we've advanced, they would think, this is terrific. But when you think of the adversary who's advancing exactly as fast and faster in many cases, and the opportunity space going by leaps and bounds, I'm not convinced that we're doing much more than keeping head above water most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that the trying is good. I don't see us as having given up. I think that the reemergence of looking at secure software and safe building of systems, which was out of fashion for a while, is heartening. And so those are positive signs.
So what's your view on professional certifications for cybersecurity versus academic degrees?
From the research standpoint, I have to say that we have not found those particularly useful. When we've hired people on the research side, of course, we're looking more at their capacity to do research and to think broadly, not always for cybersecurity skills. In fact, some of our best people are coming from other sciences, biological sciences, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So the certification isn't buying us that much in terms of extra add value. In some ways, from a researcher standpoint, they're a bit more tied to the current system, and that's a hindrance when you're trying to look 10 years downstream.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that academic degrees do a reasonable job preparing the workforce for doing what needs doing in cybersecurity?
Some do and some don't. I would say that we're getting some excellent students out of places like Tulsa who mm-hmm. have a good feel for what's going on. We've hired some very good people out of Virginia Tech, for instance. I have looked at some other institutions, and I'm a little less happy with what I'm seeing. They are, I think, more geared towards compliance, which is a valuable thing, but it's not so much a useful thing for me on the research side.
Mm-hmm. I see a lot of that in the government, in what's known as the assurance community, I suppose, where assurance in many cases means a whole lot of bureaucracy. Is your view the same, or have I just not, you know, looked in the right places?
Some of it's useful. What I do find happens, unfortunately, with assurance, I'm sure you've seen this too, is that we set a standard, and it's intended to be, in most cases, the least amount of security that's acceptable for that system. And that's what we mean when we set the standard there. If everyone meets the standards, they will at least have the basics. But unfortunately, assurance culture tends to be now that this is the standard, the maximum that's required. And that's a bad mindset. If what we consider the minimum now becomes the maximum, we're not really meeting the basics in all cases. We're going through a lot of effort and not necessarily being more secure than we would be if we had a bit looser view of what was required and a little bit higher standard.
Mm-hmm. We still don't have enough women in computer science, much less computer security. So if you were to go back and chat with yourself about becoming a scientist before you became one, what would you tell yourself to motivate yourself? How's that for a counterfactual?
Now, that is an interesting question, especially since I'm not certain that I listened to people too well while I was deciding what I wanted to do with
my career. I think you'd listen to yourself, though, wouldn't you?
I'd hope so. Well, I think that what I what would have worked with me then is what did work with me. And what I saw is that there was this huge need for improvements in cybersecurity. I've mentioned before to others that I was drawn to this field at about the time of the Morris worm. And mm-hmm. I was just so angry that a technology that was supposed to help people communicate with one another was instead being used to harm one another's systems. I was furious. And I think that a lot of people, a lot of women, for instance, like fields because they feel like they can make a difference, they can improve things, they can help protect. And that's what drew me in. And I think that's what I would say today. I'd go back and say, hey, Deb, you know, this is a field where you actually could make a difference if you stick with it.
Yeah, that's an interesting view. I do think that there's a pretty big difference between why men tend to get involved in computer security and why women tend to get involved, having asked this question of a bunch of women in the podcast over the last few years.
I've been interested when I've heard you interview the men. A lot of times I'm hearing them discuss how much they enjoyed playing with gadgets and so on. And I did too, but that wasn't enough to get me interested in computer security. It wasn't until I had a cause, so to speak, that I felt like this was the profession that I wanted to stick with.
Mm-hmm. And a final question for you. What is your favorite flower?
Ooh, actually, it is the orchid.
Is it
the
orchid?
Dendrobium.
I thought it might be the daffodil.
I love daffodils, but if you tried to plant 100,000 orchids outside in my woods, Gary, you'd need to have deep pocket books and no deer.
Yeah, that's right. No deer and more rain probably, huh?
Absolutely.
Huh. Well, thanks very much for your time today, Deb. It's been fantastic.
Thank you, Gary. I enjoyed it.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The September-October issue of IEEE S&P features articles on embedded in cyber-physical systems. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.